It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore citizen science, dozens of volunteers in the DNR's rare plant monitoring program, and the work to advance rare plant conservation here in Wisconsin. Share what you wonder about vulnerable species. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kevin Doyle is a botanist with the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation in the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, coordinating the DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program. Kevin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the clustered broom rape near Lake Michigan. A volunteer found this rare plant. Why was this find such an important discovery?
Yeah, so clustered broom rape is a state threatened plant. It's been found about 9 times in Wisconsin over the last, I don't know, over 100 years. But only 4 of the populations have been seen relatively recently. So like, let's say in the last 40 years. So it's a super rare plant. And it had been searched for, this particular population in Manitowoc had been searched for a number of times without success. And then in 2022, a volunteer named Tom Underwood went out there. He'd looked for it in 2018 without finding it. But sure enough, in 2022, he found it. So it was great news for us, you know, that this population is still around of this really rare plant. But as you can imagine, the kind of information that we can collect in 2022 is much better than we could collect in 1979. So we have GPS coordinates on exactly where the plants were found, which will hopefully make finding it in the future easier, keeping track of it, keeping it out of harm's way, that kind of thing. But then we also have updated information on how is the population doing, what are the threats, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so you're really able to hone in on it. Can you describe what it looks like for us?
Yeah. Cluster broom rape is a small little plant. It gets maybe 6 inches, but I think that would be a pretty big plant. And it's parasitic, so it doesn't produce chlorophyll, so it's not green. It's usually like a maroon to even yellow kind of color. It doesn't have real big leaves. They're more like scales up and down the stem, which again is short. And so it's... as you can imagine, it can be pretty inconspicuous and hard to find. So, which made it even cooler that this volunteer was able to pick it out.
And your volunteer, Tom, had a hunch where to find it. Do volunteers have leads in knowing where to look for these rare plants?
Yeah. So once they take a training and, you know, do a follow-up quiz and sign a confidentiality agreement, we're able to provide them with all the information that we have on where these rare plants are located to help them try to find them. So the focus of the program is to relocate known rare plant populations. And so in order to do that, we have to arm them with maps or GPS coordinates if we have them, or written directions on how to get to these plants, information on how big the population was, what date it has been found, what the habitat looks like, all that kind of stuff. So whatever we have that would help them in their search, we provide to them.
What is that confidentiality aspect?
So rare species are sensitive. They're often occur in small populations. Maybe they're sensitive to changes in their environment. And so we really want to protect that information. We don't share that information with the public. We only share it to the township level, which is 36 square miles. So we don't share those precise localities with the general public, but with members of this program, because they're helping us relocate these things and are collecting data for us, then we'll provide them with that information. So the confidentiality agreement just says, I'm not going to share this information with the general public.
Okay. Kevin Doyle with us, botanist with the state DNRs. We talk about rare and threatened plants and the role of citizen scientists who go out and find them as part of the DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program. You can join in with your questions at any point at 800-642-1234. Kevin, what is the threshold or the definition of what is a rare plant?
Yeah, so there's legal definitions, like endangered species are defined as those that are at risk of extirpation, so disappearing from the state. Threatened species are species that are at risk of becoming endangered. So there's some legal definition that has to do with how at risk of they are of disappearing from the state. But to put numbers on it, we have 322 species listed as endangered, threatened, or special concern. And if you were to line up the populations of all of them, the average plant has about 10 or fewer populations in the state. So to give people a sense of like how rare is rare, the average plant, so about half of the plants that we have, the half of that 322 have 10 or fewer populations. Now, some have many more. There are some plants like purple milkweed that people might be familiar with. We have like maybe 100 populations documented, but that documentation goes back over 100 years. So there might be a record of purple milkweed from Madison in 1875. You know, the likelihood that that is still there is might be pretty low, but it's still in our database because it helps tell the story of that plant. It helps give us a sense of its historic distribution to see how that might be changing over time, all that kind of stuff. But in general, the most plants have about 10 or fewer populations.
So last year, volunteers went looking for 29 rare plants but couldn't find them. What does that signal?
Yeah, we call these negative reports or negative data when you go out and look for something and don't find it. It could mean a lot of things. And so the kind of data the volunteers collect is really important. So for example, someone could go out and look for a plant, but you know, they were running late. They had some other things to do. They looked for the plant for 20 minutes. They said the habitat looks pretty good, but I just didn't find the plant. That's really different than from someone who went out, crawled around on their hands and knees for 3 hours, didn't find the plant, and the habitat was overrun with invasive species and deer browse was really bad. Those two things tell two different stories. So certainly there are cases of real decline in rare and, to be honest, common plants. I think we all are aware of these stories of species decline. So these negative reports are really important for raising the red flag. What species should we be concerned with? What are these trends? How are these species doing? What are their trends? But it also is important to get the context of each survey so we can identify which ones are likely actual declines and which ones are just the survey didn't have enough time to find the plant.
And if you have about 50 volunteers who all get the same training, are they with you for a duration? Do they spend years with you?
Certainly some do. I think like a lot of volunteer programs, you know, people get involved and they participate for a few years and then they move on to other things. But we certainly have a lot of people that have contributed now for almost 10 years. The program started in 2013. And we definitely have people that have been contributing data, going out on surveys for most of that time, and then new people come in every year too.
Kevin Doyle is a botanist with the Wisconsin DNR coordinating its rare plant monitoring program, documenting the significant rare plant discoveries in the midst of climate change and invasive species. Be part of this conversation. Call in with your questions, your thoughts anytime. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here as we examine highlights of the DNR's rare plant monitoring program and what the discoveries of rare plants mean for the environment and conservation. Join in at any point. Call in with your questions, your comments about vulnerable species, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Botanist Kevin Doyle coordinates the DNR's rare plant monitoring program. Kevin, let's look at another success story from the monitoring program, and that is the Northern Camandra, one of the rarest plants in Wisconsin. What is the status of this plant population?
Yeah, so Northern Camandra, super rare in Wisconsin, state endangered. There's only two populations known in the state, both from Door County. And one of them was relocated last year. So I said with clustered broomrape, that's a parasitic plant. This is a partially parasitic plant. So it does have green leaves, but it also gets a lot of water and nutrients by parasitizing nearby plants. It's related to bastard toadflax, if people are familiar with that prairie plant. There's two populations in the state. One was found in 2022 for the first time in 20 years. So again, it's another example of suddenly we have a lot better information on how the plant is doing. We have precise GPS coordinates, and we have an update on the condition, the vigor of that population. Right now, the DNR is updating our endangered and threatened species list. And part of those assessments to see which species should be endangered and threatened is trends, understanding how the populations increasing, decreasing, are they stable? If they're increasing, how fast? If they're decreasing, how fast? And so we need, you know, multiple data points along over these years to interpret trends. And so if a population hasn't been seen in over 20 years, it's really hard or impossible really to assess trends. So the data that we got on that survey in 2022 was really helpful to see like, well, actually, yeah, this population is pretty stable. It's doing pretty good. I think the other noteworthy thing, or the thing worth mentioning about this Northern Camandra survey was there's only two populations in the state. And I think maybe sometimes people might think like, oh, well, if there's only two populations of a plant, we're probably on top of it. The DNR or the general public has probably visited those populations a number of times because there's only two of them. But that's just not the case. Like I said earlier, are over 320 of these species that we're concerned about. And if you add up all their populations, there's over 6,000 have been documented, and just on public land, there's over 3,000. So that's way more than I can keep up with.
You need your army of volunteers, Kevin.
Correct.
Is there a part of the state that is most abundant with rare or endangered plants?
Good question. There's definitely hot spots around the state. So the corners of the state are usually hotspots because one of the reasons for rare plants being rare is that they're at the edge of their range. So they barely sneak into the state. So Door County is a hotspot. The city of Superior is a hotspot because there's plants that are more common further north, but barely sneak into the northwest corner of the state. And there's a lot of wetlands up there, a lot of really kind of unique wetland types and types of soil. So there's plants there. There's other causes for hotspots are just areas where there's a lot of public land. So the lower Wisconsin State Riverway in southwest Wisconsin has a lot of public land. And so that provides people with an opportunity to go out and botanize, we would say, or search for these plants. So there's a number of hotspots. The Baraboo Hills is another hotspot. And then in southeast Wisconsin, the Southern Kettle Moraine is a particular hotspot for, there's a lot of prairie plants and savanna plants found in the Southern Kettle Moraine. So that's a really important spot. And that, again, it's there's a lot of public land down there. And then it's, you know, it's in the crosshairs of Milwaukee and Madison. So there's a lot of people to look for this stuff. That helps. And then on top of that, there's a lot of management going on. There's a lot of groups, whether it's the DNR or the Nature Conservancy or local land trusts, that are actively burning or removing invasive species from a lot of these sites. So it's not perfect, but they're getting a lot of help down there. And that's showing in the number of rare plants we find.
You mentioned invasive species, and I wonder what impact are they having on what makes your list and the future of these rare plants?
Yeah, it's a major concern, a major threat. There's a lot of reasons. Rare plants are rare, but invasive species is certainly one of the biggest. In southern Wisconsin, the problem is probably worse than it is in northern Wisconsin. Not to say that we're not concerned about it in northern Wisconsin, but they've kind of taken hold in southern Wisconsin in a way they haven't quite got to in northern Wisconsin. So yeah, it's a constant battle to preserve these areas. I think historically there might have been a thought that, like, if we just protect the property, if the DNR buys the land or the Nature Conservancy buys the land and turns it into a preserve, then that's great. That's good enough. And I think now we're moving into a second phase where we can't just protect the land. We actually have to manage it and put in the work to remove the invasives and do prescribed fires and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a constant battle. It's habitat degradation is certainly one of the biggest causes of rare species decline, not just rare plants, and invasives are a big part of that degradation.
Big part of that story. Kevin Doyle, who coordinates the DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program, giving us insights into what this program is about and the volunteers who help make it happen. You can join in with your questions about rare and threatened plants at 800-642-1234. Kevin, volunteers reported 10 populations of kittentails in Wisconsin, including a new population on private land. What is significant about this plant?
So kittentails is one of the rare plants that's found in the Southern Kettle Moraine that I was just talking about as being a hotspot. Kittentails is what we would call a Midwest endemic plant. So that means it's in across the world, it's only found in the upper Midwest of the United States. And within that small distribution, the Southern Kettle Moraine of Wisconsin is probably the core of the species distribution. So we have more populations in the Southern Kettle Moraine, and those populations are healthier than pretty much anywhere else in the world. So it's a really important species for Wisconsin, and the Southern Kettles are a really important species for it. We call these kind of species responsibility species because Wisconsin, having this sort of outsized number of populations of the species, we have an outsized responsibility to protect them.
I thought I knew what kittentails look like. Can you explain how they look? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so the leaves are, they look like plantain leaves,
yes,
that people might see in their like front yard. So it's not particularly charismatic.
I did
in
a double
regard.
Take, yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like if people are familiar with Heartleaf Golden Alexander, I'd like to think they're more similar to that because it's a little more flattering than plantain. But and then it has tall stalks of yellow flowers. The whole plant probably doesn't get more than a foot tall, so it's not real big. But yeah, it's kind of these. It looks similar to a plantain.
As we close out here, your program is expanding staff. What will additional staff allow you to accomplish?
Yeah, we're excited that we just hired a second botanist who will help coordinate the program, Jessica Ross. So we're really excited to have her on staff. And I think that will allow us to expand the program in ways we haven't been in the past. So, for example, maybe we'll have more in-person events over the summer, maybe things like kind of group rare plant blitzes where we go to a site where there's a number of rare plants known and we all kind of scatter out working in teams and do that kind of thing. So that'll be good. I think just being able to improve communication, just build capacity on our end to facilitate all these volunteers doing this great work for us to hopefully improve their ability to go out and find these things.
Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Kevin Doyle is a botanist with the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation in the Wisconsin DNR, coordinates the DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association approves a plan that could significantly alter the landscape of competition for middle school and high school sports. Be part of the discussion. Call in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michelle Guyant-Holloway is athletic director at Wauwatosa East High School, co-chair of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. Michelle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much, Kate. I appreciate you having me.
So here in last month in April, the members approved this competitive balance plan to take effect in the 2024-2025 school year. What concerns is this plan seeking to address in sports?
Well, there has been some membership thoughts that there has been some possible competitive imbalance in our school. Particularly when it comes to the tournament series. And it was addressed back in 2014 with a success factor plan that failed at that time. And back in 2021, the Board of Control had the WIA staff move forward with creating a competitive balance ad hoc committee to examine the situation again at this point in time. And so that's kind of where we started from.
So competitive balance, that terminology may be new or a little bit unclear, confusing. How do you best describe it?
It's trying to be able to provide as fair and chance for schools to have an opportunity to be able to compete in the tournament series. It used to be referred to as competitive equity. It's now been called competitive balance. And really the idea and the thought was, you know, we're making it as fair and as equitable as possible for schools. Because the perception out there was that some schools have more of an advantage and others have a disadvantage. And we felt that then looking and examining this competitive balance of being able to try to, you know, in a sense, give that balance, give that fairness to everyone.
So take us into the plan here and how it awards points to teams for being successful in state tournaments. How does that work, and how do you anticipate teams could be moved up or down divisions?
Sure. That point system was really a part of the initial plan back in 2014 that I mentioned. And so the points would be looking at a three-year timetable for each particular sport. So let's just say girls basketball, for an example. A school would then be looked at for their 3 years, and if they had success in the postseason tournament, in the tournament series, then they're going to get accumulated certain points ranging from 1 for sectional advancement all the way up to 4 points for winning the state tournament. And so over those 3 years, these points will be added. And let's say in 2 years' time, they won a state championship. And then the next year, they were runners-up. So they've accumulated at that point 4 points for winning the state tournament and 3 points for getting to the state tournament game. They've then accumulated 7 points. And then they will have advanced over those 6 points. That next year, then, they would be promoted up to a different division. So if they were, this is a girls basketball team that won a state tournament 1 year and took second the next year at, say, Division III, then they would be promoted up to the Division II level in order for their competition because of their performances at the state tournament.
So that is an example of a promotion going up a division. What about the other way, moving down a division?
For moving down a division, if we're just talking about from the points theory, certainly there is there'll be a running total as well, too, of those points. So let's say that third year, they, you know, still advanced and maybe they, you know, went to the state tournament, but they didn't win a game at the state tournament. So they'll still accumulate a couple of points. They'll accumulate 2 points. But then the next year after that, they don't advance to the state tournament. And then the next year after that, they don't. So they haven't accumulated points in those next years. Then they would be rolled down, moved down, once they have any points less than those 6 points a total. So it'll be a running total for schools to move down to be able to make sure that they can move down in a quicker fashion. That was the goal for the committee was to be able to have them be able to move down. If we're just talking of just the point system itself, that they would be able to move down in a faster rate. So as soon as they drop below 6 points, that's girls basketball team at Division III that moved up to two, then they're going to move down.
So what happens to the spirit and the tradition? Like, for instance, you mentioned basketball, but, you know, in football, what happens to these longtime rivalries if schools move divisions?
It has nothing to do with anything that they'll do during the school year. This strictly has to deal with come the championship or the tournament series after the regular season is done. So anything within the normal regular season, this does not affect that.
And in terms of geography, if your team is moving divisions and having to travel greater distances, would that strain budgets? Is that a concern?
That's a really good question. We felt that in our state that we have a lot of divisions that are nearby each other in a sense. So if we're looking at, you know, Northwest Wisconsin, there's a lot of Division II, Division III, Division IV schools already that encompass that area. So if a school moves from a Division IV to a Division III, there may be a little bit additional travel, but we don't feel that there's going to be anything that's going to be dramatic. We even still sometimes have it within the current division format where a school has a 2-hour drive and they try to find a location in the middle, even right now with how the tournament structure is. So I don't believe that we felt that there is going to be anything greater than what we already currently have to do sometimes.
Michelle Guyant-Holloway with us, co-chair of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force, explaining how competitive balance will be working in our state. You can join in on these new rules of competition for middle and high school sports, 800-642-1234 to join in with your question. Michelle, the plan would apply to individual sports at schools rather than being school-wide or district-wide. Does that approach give teams a better shot at advancing in state tournaments?
That's where we felt that it is such an individual sport related. Obviously, as a school, you know, there can be some programs that have some very good success in certain sports within their school, but then others that are not as successful. And so when you just target each individual sport, it gives that a more overarching opportunity for schools to be able to address what is more specific within that sport. So we did believe that that will be, gives a little bit more flexibility and more opportunity for schools to make those decisions as to what sports maybe are in need of some assistance. And that's where, you know, the request aspect that's part of this plan allows that opportunity for a school. So if there's a school that has some big enrollment drop that's coming up, they're in a rural area, so they don't have a lot of students to, you know, kind of in a sense choose from, and if they need some relief, that they're able to ask for that in the request process of this particular plan. So that's why we wanted to keep it very more individualized for each sport to be able to have their opportunity for, you know, kind of being able to rectify whatever problems or issues that they have that they feel that they need to move down a division.
And is that like an appeals process? You know, on what grounds can a school appeal being moved up or down in the level of competition?
So the request process, as I just mentioned, is at the very beginning part of this seven-step plan. So any school is able to, at the very beginning, after enrollments are determined, can ask for assistance, can ask for a request.
Okay.
That's to move up or down. Some schools may want to move up, knowing that they have you know, good, better competition, and they want to be able to move up division. Or as I mentioned, if there's a school that's struggling and has some certain areas that they can address, that they are able to move down. And we have eight criteria that's listed to be able to have that school stay. These are some of the reasons as to why we need to move down. The same eight criteria that's used for the request process is once we get the tournament performance point system in place, those schools that then are affected and have been promoted up due to their tournament performance factor points, they will have an opportunity to appeal. We have a classification committee that is formed, and they will be able to make that appeal to the committee as to why that they shouldn't, even though they have more than the 6 points, why they shouldn't be moved up a division. So we have these two processes in place for either requesting for schools to move up or down, or after the tournament performance factor points are applied, a school is able to appeal and state their case as to why they feel that they shouldn't be moved up.
Michelle Guyant-Holloway is athletic director at Wauwatosa East High School, co-chairs the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. Call in with questions or comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the new competitive balance plan moving forward for high school sports and efforts to help schools be competitive in tournament play. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michelle Guyant-Holloway is athletic director at Wauwatosa East High School, co-chairs the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. So, Michelle, a bit of that history you touched on, that this is the second time around for the WIAA attempting to address competitive balance. The 2015 plan was voted down by the organization's membership. What is different this time around?
That's a great question, Kate, and we were very conscious of that as we were formed when we were started off on this this journey. And the biggest differences are the two items that I just spoke about in regards to the request and to the appeals process. We felt that there was a need for schools to be able to have a strong opportunity to request. Everyone's got disparate situations at their schools and with certain sports. And so the request process was really a key item to have at the beginning parts of the stages. And we were able to look at different states. And while we were creating this plan and the criteria really came about from the Colorado and their plan that they've instituted just within the last few years themselves. And then the appeal process, we really felt that we wanted our schools to be able to have an opportunity that even after they were moved up for their performance factors in the tournament, that they still have an opportunity to state, well, maybe this upcoming year, we have had a change and there's things that have happened within our school or we see a trend that's changing here and we don't feel that we should be able to stay in this upper division at this point in time. And so we wanted to give them that opportunity to state their case and make that appeal be able to go to the committee. So those two were the real big key changes.
I wonder, will this require more regulatory work from the WIAA?
Well, the classification committee is going to be the group that's going to be hearing the requests and the appeals from the schools. We felt that it was wanting the membership to be able to have part of that process and not putting it onto strictly the WIA's shoulders, the staff members up there. That's where sometimes I think we've learned in the past that may have hindered some relationships. And so if we come at it from our membership is working with our other membership, that was, a better fit. So we have anywhere between 15 to 20 people being superintendents, district administrators, principals, athletic directors that will be part of this classification committee that then will hear all these appeals and requests and be able to make that decision that way. Certainly the WIA will have a staff member that will be a liaison that will work with the classification committee. But very similar to what we have in our conference realignment, that committee, they listen, they hear, and then they make their changes. The classification committee will do the same. They'll be addressing and listening to those requests and appeals.
Let's bring on a call now. Joe in Platteville is here. Joe, hi.
Hello. Doug Chickering, when he was head of WIA, looked into a point system to try to even out the private schools who recruit and really were able to do a lot in the state tournament. And what he found in Illinois, they had that point system, and it just made them win more championships because they were so good that they spread out in all the divisions and just kept winning. Even though they put them up a division, it didn't matter. They'd still won.
Is that point system still in effect in Illinois, Joe? Do you know?
Sure. Doug Chickering was the head of WIA quite a while ago, but that's what he told us at a coaching clinic, that the point system they had in Illinois made the private schools have more championships instead of evening out the competition.
Michelle, what are your insights there?
I was not around as a high school athletic director at that time when Doug Chickering was the head of the WIA. So to that specific idea at that time, I can't address that. But I can address that, when we examined the first group in 2014, 2015, looked and examined that, this point system came from Indiana. At that time and looked at that where it was successful. It was an opportunity to be able to, regardless of what school, if you were successful in the tournament, that you were going to have these points be able to be added and addressed that way. And we've had success from a lot of our state tournaments being from a variety of schools, small, large, rural, urban, private, public. So we felt that having a point system at this point in time still was maybe more relative than at that point. Again, I can't address the idea was at that time, but we feel that this was still a value even in today's time.
Michelle Guyant-Holloway, co-chair of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. Let's go to Keegan in Minocqua. Keegan, hi.
Hi. My question is more about individual sports like wrestling, swimming, and track, where certain athletes can go to state, but maybe not the whole team. And I was wondering if this point system has an effect on those types of sports.
Yeah, that's a great question. We had, as a committee, we actually created a subcommittee with many of the athletic directors that were on the committee to examine the point system structure. And we broke it down into bracketed sports, which are your more traditional team sports of wrestling, basketball, hockey, soccer, and so forth. And then the non-bracketed sports were categorized in another area, your cross country, your golf, your tennis, because of the nature of how those sports are created once they come into the tournament series. We saw a distinction between those types of sports of those that are in a bracket that are traditional in the tournament series to those that are in a non-bracket, even in that sense, so that it was be able to have a distinction between those because they are different formats at that point in time. And so even though the point systems of 1 through 4 that schools would still be or sports programs would still be accumulating, it is a little bit different, for those non-bracketed sports. So for an example, for cross country, if a team qualifies for the state meet, they're going to get 1 point. Whereas in a bracketed sport, the team is going to advance to the state quarterfinal or their sectional final. Or for football, if they get to level 3, they're going to earn that point at that point in time. So we did have a distinction between those bracketed and those non-bracketed sports.
Well, Michelle, we appreciate your helping us understand this. Thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate your time. I've been reaching out and discussing this this topic, and thank you so much, Kate, for having me on.
Michelle Guyant-Holloway is athletic director at Wauwatosa East High School and co-chair of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association's Competitive Balance Task Force. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.